everyone, to a brand new episode of Talking Movies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Rod Sony.
And your other co-host, Sam.
Thank you for joining us. We don't have any overlapping reviews, but we're going to be reviewing plenty of new releases between Sam and myself later on in the episode. And a lot of cool new stories, I think, to cover this week. Some stuff that was kind of unexpected, but really took us for a spin. Let's start with Zack Snyder's newest movie. I think a lot of people were maybe expecting him to possibly continue that Justice League lore, maybe continue on with his vision of the Snyder Cut and give us a part two like he was originally intended to. But we found out this week that Zack Snyder is continuing his partnership with Netflix, who released Army of the Dead, and he's going to be releasing a movie called Rebel Moon. I think there was like some confusion upon release of this news as to what exactly this movie is. People thought it was maybe going to be like a Star Wars movie. I know that's kind of how I saw it from the news article. But then we sort of later clarified that what this is Zack Snyder has had this project in the works or sort of ideating for a while in terms of a Star Wars movie that he thought was going to be Kurosawa inspired. But it looks like this is going to be taking that script, that concept, and making it an original project. So it is still that Star Wars inspired Kurosawa script, but it's not set in the Star Wars universe. It's a separate thing, Rebel Moon, like very sort of Star Wars-esque, but it's not actually a Star Wars movie. It sounds exciting, Sam, but like, you know, what's your thoughts on like the confusion and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, when you sent me the article, I was like, wait, he's going to pairing himself up with Star Wars? I think Star Wars is going up a bit off the deep end going with Zack Snyder, because Zack Snyder doesn't seem like somebody who would make a Star Wars-friendly movie. Mm. But then, you know, it was cleared up that it was an original teaming up with Netflix. But you know, it's half excitement, half skepticism. Excitement because I'm really excited to see how Snyder's take on the space epic that's probably gonna be R-rated, but right. Also skeptical because he's pairing himself off again with his core writer on Army of the Dead, which was a movie I didn't like too much.
Right. Is there like any concern that because this was originally supposed to be a Star Wars movie, or he wanted it to be a Star Wars movie, this is gonna be like, it's going to feel like knockoff, sort of like ripoff Star Wars.
I was thinking about it because I was trying to think of how he would incorporate his own sensibilities into a Star Wars movie and what kind of Star Wars movie it would be. I'm guessing with the title, it's going to be rebel related and, you know, people or like, you know, a small rebel group fighting against, you know, a large evil empire, which is kind of like the sensibility I'm getting because it is Star Wars influence and the title itself. So it's going to be interesting to see how he's going to make his own spin on it because he's a very R-rated director, someone who's very uncompromising in his vision.
Right.
So hopefully we'll get a more of Snyder as opposed to more of a Star Wars movie, but we'll wait and see how this one turns out.
Yeah, and the other sort of part of it that I thought was maybe going to be like too close to Star Wars, the fact that it was Kurosawa inspired, which Star Wars itself already is from like Hidden Fortress and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like, is it going to be some sort of sword fighting, like too close to lightsabers? Like, I don't know. I'm excited for it because I feel like Zack Snyder could have kind of been a fresh voice in Star Wars in terms of like doing something bold, like you said, like R-rated. Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to see that take on a Star Wars project. So like, in that sense, I'm excited, like sort of on paper, but I don't know. I feel like I'm also just trepidatious because it's so close to what Star Wars actually is.
Well, and there's also the same, you know, pairing, like auteur filmmakers paying themselves off with Netflix and Netflix just giving them the rights to do whatever they want, and Netflix having all the money in the world apparently to make whatever they want. Yeah. You know, there is that, you know, there is that optimism of, you know, an artist's vision not being compromised and them getting the budget that they need to create their vision.
Right, and Army of the Dead was like one of Netflix's best performing movies of all time, right, in terms of original stuff that they've mm-hmm. produced, I think. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense. It definitely makes sense. But I guess like sort of cautious optimism from both of us moving forward. Yes. With this one. I want to see who they cast. I want to see sort of more details about the plot. Hopefully we'll find out a lot of that stuff soon because it looks like this is going to be the next thing that he's going to be going into production on. One of the craziest stories, I think, maybe that I've ever seen sort of break on the internet is we found out earlier this week that a YouTube film critic, Chris Stuckman, who I think you and I are both big fans of, mm-hmm. Is going to be launching his filmmaking career. If you watched his YouTube channel, Sam, I don't know if like you've seen the videos or if you just watched strictly his reviews, but he's been doing this thing called like My Filmmaking Journey for a few years now, where like he used to make like home movies and stuff, and he's posted them on his YouTube like with his friends back in the day. And he said, like, I think from the get-go when he started this YouTube channel is just because he wanted to get closer and closer to the film industry. And he actually put out a video about this announcement after Deadline put out the exclusive article about this movie that he's going to be producing, but he basically said that, you know, he's been shooting short films with friends, writing scripts on his own for years and years and years in an attempt to, you know, make the transition from critic to actual filmmaker. And now he's going to be writing, directing a horror movie based off these paranormal investigators that went missing off of YouTube. You know, he sort of made connections through going to film festivals as a critic and had scripts ready to go. And it's just kind of like, he's living the dream at this point. This is a really, really cool story to see a YouTube critic break out of that mold and build himself up to the point where he's actually going to be a writer director on a legitimate horror movie now.
Yeah, I feel like this is something that's just waiting to happen because, as you said, he's been making his own, you know, home movies as a kid, you know, growing up and creating his, like, you know, involving himself into the movie industry by making these videos on YouTube. And, you know, someone who I'm really admire in regards to his ability to, you know, create a huge following. He has 2 million followers on YouTube, and, you know, he has horror sensibilities. He's a huge anime fan. Somebody I kind of agree with most of the time. I see his reviews and, you know, kind of say I disagree with you, but most of the time I really, you know, in the same boat as he is. So he's a really interesting mind. He's very articulate, you know, one of the, you know, smarter individuals I follow in regards to film criticism, and someone who doesn't sensationalize his views, and someone who is very, you know, open to, you know, dialogue in regards to, you know, movies that have come out in the past and, you know, movies that have, you know, are, you know, controversial, I guess, following to it, like, you know, more right. popularly with like Star Wars and stuff. Right. And, you know, he's a really smart dude. So seeing that he gets an opportunity, like, this is very exciting to see. And I'm going to read something off of the Deadline article that kind of, you know, piqued my interest. You know, the quote goes, I had been looking for the right project to partner with Chris for a while now. And while when I fell down the rabbit hole of this scary little story quickly emerging right in Chris's backyard of Ohio with an intriguing and quickly growing YouTube element baked in, I knew we had to act fast and the perfect vehicle to launch Chris as a feature filmmaker. So the fact that it's like a YouTube-centric, you know, backstory right. in his background of Ohio, and him being a well-regarded, you know, 2 million people, I don't think that's like a very small following. You know, he's someone who is well-known in, at least in the movie industry, or at least within film criticism itself. You know, this is something really exciting to see someone, you know, that we have admired for so long get like an opportunity like this.
Yeah, it shows that if you work hard and you put in like the effort, you know, he's been writing scripts for a long, long time, and just now he's finally getting his break. But if you put in the effort and you really want to make it in this industry, the avenues are certainly there. You just have to continue to strive for it, and you can't just hope that it sort of falls on your doorstep. And yeah, it's cool that like he gets to do this in Ohio, in his hometown, like sort of close to where he grew up and raised and all that sort of stuff. So he's not like, you know, making the trek out to LA to sort of make this thing happen. Like, he made it happen on his own. So that all is cool. And I'm glad that you sort of brought up earlier on, you know, his sensibilities, his interest in anime and all that sort of stuff, because like my hope is that, like, you know, he's a very big horror movie fan obviously as well. And that's where he's making his footing, like with this smaller studio that is sort of specialized on lower budget horror movies. So he's going to like sort of wet his feet with that. And then hopefully he can grow and grow and grow. And like, he's not just stuck in like indie horror for the rest of his career, but like he can expand and do big budget projects, maybe not a Star Wars per se, but like, you know, inching closer and closer to that sort of scale. If, you know, if people really take a liking to this project, there's certainly opportunity for him to become like a sort of crazy big success story, making the ways from like uploading with like a handheld camera onto a free platform to then like, you know, directing big budget projects. I feel like that would be just one of the coolest filmmaking journeys that we've ever seen from any of these directors that are making these big time movies nowadays.
Do we know the timeline for this movie? Is it going to come out next year, 2 years from now?
I think next year, because it's going into production later this year. So it'll probably come out. My guess would probably be like closer to next, like Halloween or something, because I think it's supposed to film later this year.
The only bad thing about this is we're going to get very much, he's going to be, you know, super busy with making this movie. So we're going to get less like reviews on his YouTube channel.
Yeah, which is true. But he's like, did you watch the video where he discussed the news? I don't know if you saw it or not.
I haven't seen that one. No.
He talked about how like he might not be doing as many reviews, but he's going to be like doing like behind the scenes and sort of like talking.
I was thinking
about
he would do that. Yeah, it sounds like what he'd do.
Yeah, so it might be like a change of pace for his content. But like you said, like we're both big fans of his, so I think like anything that he posts, you and I will probably tune in and watch it. And it'll be cool to see sort of a change from him in terms of what he's doing. And he said he's going to do like a 3-part series on like how he got the job. So like the first one was the announcement. He's got 2 more videos coming out in the next couple weeks. So definitely check out those. I'll link the first one also in the show notes. So check out that in the description of the episode. Let's go on to the trailers that came out this week. Let's start with Succession season 3. It felt like this series was sort of stagnating just because like we hadn't heard really much news about production. Obviously it was shut down with COVID and whatnot. We didn't really know what the status was of season 3 in terms of when we'd actually be getting it. HBO dropped the bomb earlier this week that season 3 is coming this fall, I believe in September. And they gave us a knockout, a minute 30 second, like a 90 second trailer that was just everything that I wanted out of the season 3 sort of preview. It just looked like it was leaning exactly into the sort of storylines that season 2 set up. No spoilers, obviously, but it just looked completely in tune with what the series has been up through the first two seasons. Jesse Armstrong is just like an absolute genius when it comes to writing this. I mean, I think this is the best show on television. Would you argue with me on that?
I'm trying to think of, I would say Barry's up there. I really love Better Call Saul, but you know, Succession is really pretty. It's a good argument to say that it is the best show on TV right now. You know, it's the same consistency in regards to the storylines from season 2, consistency in tone and, you know, the frayed relationships even now more so because of what happened in season 2 that was shown in the trailer. You know, it's all very exciting. I'm really excited to see how this season turns out. And I was reading that they might go at most 5 seasons, so not right. the 3x structure we were talking about when season 2 ended, but you know, that's still smaller season order and that we were kind of expecting,
which I kind of like that. I kind of like that he's got a sort of end game in sight, and this is not like, I love this show to pieces, but it's not the kind of material where you can stretch it like 6, 7, 8 seasons. I think it is the kind of story where like you've got your 4 to 5 seasons, like Jesse Armstrong said in that interview, or one of his producers said in the interview last week or whatever it was. And it feels like he's got a game plan for where he's going with this. Mm-hmm. It was also funny to hear, like, I think they said in that interview that you're referencing that like when like real life is as crazy as it is, like you can't really stretch these sort of extreme situations in the show to outdo life, which was like what the show was supposed to be originally, sort of like a obviously like commentary on the Trump era and all that sort of stuff. But like I guess Jesse Armstrong acknowledges that like while he's got a sort of bag of ideas, a bag of tricks that he can use, like he knows that as crazy as our world has been over the past 2, 3, 4 years, like he can't really outdo reality. He's just trying to sort of comment on it and sort of go toe-to-toe with it. But like he's doing an incredible job. Like maybe it's not the best show if you don't agree with that sentiment. I agree with what you're saying on the other two shows, but like the writing is just so spot on. And like, if anything, like it's just such a smart, intelligent, well-written show.
Yeah. It's a very dense show. I feel like I need to rewatch at least season 2 before this season comes out. But the thing I'm looking forward to most is Tom and Greg's relationship, because I feel like they have the same kind of chemistry as in the past two seasons.
There were a couple, you know, maybe 10 seconds total of the two of them together in this trailer, but it was exactly what. Yeah, it was enough. I'm so excited for this season. So yeah, September season 3 is going to be dropping on HBO, and Sam and I will definitely be talking about that in depth when it does come out. Earlier today, we got our first look at Encanto. This is a new musical coming from Disney Animation. I know when we first sort of saw clips or teases of this from, I believe it was D23, like last year, there were like sort of ties to, people are saying it sort of reminded them a little bit of Coco and whatnot. I think it's just because it's, you know, it's a Latin American story. It has to do with music, or at least it seems like it's going to have to do with music from what we saw, the brief clips of it. And this minute, you know, another minute 30 or so teaser, I think sort of debunks that theory that it's going to be similar to Coco. Yeah, it's going to have like musical themes and whatnot, but it looks like it's about like some sort of like superpowered family and an outcast that's sort of like, you know, part of that family that wants to be powerful or special or something like them, and sort of is striving to do something. And it looks like it's gonna, you know, capitalize on that in true Disney fashion, like gonna hit the sort of tearjerkers of, you know, anybody can be special, that sort of theme that we saw a little bit of in like Spider-Verse, kind of is what I'm thinking of, which is I guess a weird comparison to make, but I kind of got the vibe a little bit tonally or thematically there's some similarities between the two movies.
Yeah, this is something that is very curious, because you know, it's based in Colombia and we haven't really received any attention in regards to Colombian, you know, mythical storytelling. Like the last one with Coco was a Mexican, you know, Day of the Dead kind of story. So this is really interesting to see how they handle the Colombian culture and the Colombian, you know, mysticism in regards to its music and it, and it's in, I guess it's like kind of like magic superpowers, as you said. You know, very colorful, same I guess tone and look and feel as Coco. So I would see why people would say it is similar to Coco, but you know, very much in its own way that it's very family centric, more so as opposed to Coco, because Coco felt like an action adventure story with a guy that they found in the middle of nowhere,
right?
And the main character being Miguel. But this one looks very interesting to me. I can't really say too much because the trailer, I mean, it's original songs by Lin-Manuel. I think Lin-Manuel is being a, pretty much a staple in, you know, Disney productions as of now. You know, he did he was involved in Moana, he was involved in Coco, he's involved in this one as well. So we're gonna have to see more of Lin-Manuel in Disney productions going forward, I guess. But you know, it looks interesting to say the least.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up Lin-Manuel, because I was going to ask you about that, since we sort of talked about our perception of the stuff that he's done recently within the Heights and Hamilton, and us not being as big fans as some of his stuff as other people seem to be. So like, I was going to ask you if there was any trepidation going into this. Like, it seems like he's more sort of on the music side, but like, this isn't, I guess, going to be like a strict musical in the way that In the Heights is. It's going to be a more proper Disney musical where the songs will sort of appear to help progress the story, but it's not going to be like talking through music.
I would say there's no trepidation because I really enjoyed the stuff in Moana and Coco. Right, I don't think we're bringing the same sensibilities from Hamilton and In the Heights in a, you know, Disney animated production.
I'm on the same page as you with that. And you know, sort of speaking on the Colombian front, like, I don't know, maybe it's just because my sort of like capacity in terms of what I've seen is limited, or maybe it's actually just because what Hollywood has produced is limited, but it's also cool to see. Like, I feel like the stories that we've gotten, you know, specifically about Colombian families have focused like on drugs and that sort of the impact of that
narcos
and all that stuff. Like, I'm glad to see that Disney is sort of bucking that trend and doing a more, like you said, family oriented drama story, and not focused, like, sort of trying to like debunk that mythology of that being like the only kind of story that Hollywood can produce about that specific region in the world.
The thing I really appreciated when watching the trailer was not only their, you know, commitment to having a much, you know, a very authentic feeling Colombian movie, or Colombian feeling, you know, culturally sensitive movie, but the fact that they're putting in, you know, people that are much more darker complexion in Colombian movie, because, you know, as we've seen in Coco just felt like a much more, you know, familiar in regards to the complexion of the characters, but you know, in Colombia and more people like down south in that area, they're, you know, black, like they're black people that speak Spanish, and that's something that they incorporated into this movie, which is something I really appreciated.
Yeah, and it is sort of, I guess, in a way, like another sort of spin on that Lin-Manuel story is like, we had the Afro-Latino community thing that happened within the Heights, and Disney sort of, you know, trying to make right on that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because that was not something that I was even familiar with. So like, for people like me, it's going to educate us, and for people like you that have a little bit more familiarity of that region, like
I have an uncle that's Colombian.
Oh, do you really? There yeah. You go. It's probably hitting pretty close to home. Have you been to Colombia, or are your uncle here in America?
My parents have. I haven't though.
Okay. Because I know, I mean, that I as I was talking about Parts Unknown recently, and one of the episodes that I watched was the Colombia episode where Anthony Bourdain went there in season one, and like, it was just cool to see the way that he interacted with the people there and how he like those people put like a spotlight on their culture and say like, you know, we understand that a couple years ago the drug situation here was very, very bad, but our society's on the uprise and we're sort of like trying to change that perception of this area. And there, it looked spectacular, like seeing some of the places that he went there in Colombia, the food looked amazing. So like, I'm glad that Hollywood sort of taking that pivot on that situation and, you know, giving us a brighter light on that area.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because most of the stories that are involved with like Latin America, like, you know, with like the Aztecs, the people in Peru, I forget the name, the Incas, and like Mexican stories. So I'm really glad that they're focusing on a country that is not really, you know, given a lot of light in regards to pop culture.
Right. And say what you will about like the way that Disney handled some of those things, like in the 90s, like, but they still told diverse, you know, whether or not they cast Americans in the roles or not, like they still told diverse stories, like Pocahontas, like Mulan, like stories that were international, Aladdin, obviously, like, and I understand that, you know, there's some controversy in terms of them casting, you know, white voice actors back in the day, but they've been telling those kind of stories for a while now. They've been trying to put spotlights on different cultures for a while now. And I think that's something that like Disney doesn't get enough credit for doing that, having been doing that, especially like, you know, they obviously, people pull back to the early days of Disney where there was a lot of racist stuff in their features, but I think they've evolved quite a bit, and especially in the 90s and into now our modern era. Like, Disney's done a lot for a lot of different people, and I'm glad to see that they're doing that, continuing to do that now with their most recent projects. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and get into reviews now, Sam. I know you got sort of the big review of the week, so why don't you launch your stuff? I don't know if you want to talk about your other stuff first, if you want to launch straight with the big one.
I'll launch straight into this one. I mean, yeah, I'm a week late, but this is like the big movie coming out this summer, you know, along with Black Widow. But I finally got a chance to see Fast and Furious 9.
Don't ask me.
It's not great. You know, I think this is the second movie, you know, back to back that I fell asleep during the climax. I don't remember much. It's the same kind of story where it's like, you know, they have to stop this like tech warfare kind of thing from, you know, infesting the world, and they kind of make a twist on it by incorporating more of Dom's past and his, you know, quote unquote brother, with John Cena playing his brother. I forget his name. I'm awful with names. I couldn't even remember what this was because it wasn't that great. I appreciated their commitment to the family theme, but at this point, it's a meme. I don't know if you've been on social media at all, but there's this huge thing going around where, like, they're juxtaposing Dom's character, or Vin Diesel's Dom character, into different movies and saying something like, you can't defeat me. Or, like, say, for example, Marvel, like, you can't defeat me, and, like, you just can't because I have the power of family on my side.
Right.
And, like, the next panel is of him driving his muscle car into whatever situation that he's in. So they're kind of stagnating their story right now with both, you know, they're involving so much with, like, the tech stuff that they incorporated in the last, I guess, two movies, or the last movie at least. I don't remember much at all from the last, I guess, since number six, I guess you could say. And, you know, it's just kind of it's a path that they've done so much now that it's become so boring to watch. And I was kind of sleepy going into the movie. I fell asleep during the climax, and there is a jump the shark moment where they do jump the shark, and I'll spoil it now. I don't think people really care.
Yeah, spoil
they
it,
do.
I don't care.
They do go into space. They have a car that goes into space. They strap a fucking rocket to the back of a car.
It's in the trailer. I don't think that's even a spoiler. Like, they show the car that you're talking about.
And Ludacris and Tyrese are wearing, like, scuba suits. They're not really actually wearing, like, actual,
right,
like, astronaut suits. It's kind of silly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't want... They're saying that the 10th movie is going to be a two-parter, and that Vin Diesel wants to make a musical out of it at some point, and, like, you know what? I think you guys can stop after this one. Mm-hmm. And, like, this, it's the same ending every single time. They just go back to Dom's house, have a cookout, and then move in.
I'll ask, since you bring up, like, the social media conversation, like, I haven't seen reviews or anything for this movie. So, like, what is the perception of this online?
I think it has a positive score on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's like around 60 on Rotten Tomatoes right now, and like a 55, 57 score. I gave it 2 stars on Letterboxd, and I haven't seen a lot of people talk about it, but one of my friends said it's like a fun movie to watch to turn your brain off. But for me, because of the fact that it's been, I feel like, the same story for the past 4 movies, it feels boring to me.
Yeah, and I guess, like, I don't know, I'm sort of mixed on it, in the sense that, like, I feel like they're, like, sort of guilty pleasure franchises that, like, continue to make movies, but I don't even know if this is, like, one of those. It just feels, like you said, like, it's just repetitive, and they're just, like, big, bombastic. Anybody that knows me knows that I'm just not a fan of these movies.
The best way to describe it is beating a dead horse.
Yeah, it really just seems like 10 movies. Like, who would have thought when the first one came out in 2001 or whatever that they'd be 10 movies into this franchise almost? Like, it's just kind of insane to me, especially if you include, like, Hobbs and Shaw. Like, that is 10 movies now, right? So there'll be, like, 11, I guess, once... I always forget that Hobbs and Shaw even came out. Like, I'm kind of speechless when it comes to this franchise. Like, I don't know what to say about it. It peaked at Fast 5 for me, and then it just was, like, downhill with Fast 6 and Fast 7. I didn't see Fast 8 or Fast 9, whatever the hell
it's
called.
What? You know what's funny? Rotten Tomatoes came out with the infographic. The first 4 had rotten scores, and the last, you know, from 5 to now, have had positive scores.
That's interesting. I'm pretty surprised. So Fast 5 was when it turned then?
Yes, Fast 5 was the one with the heist, and the first time we see Dwayne Johnson's character.
Right. Do you like the Tokyo one, Tokyo Drift?
So my favorites are, one, the first one is the one that, you know, pretty much introduced me to the franchise. Tokyo Drift being the third one, which is another favorite, and 5. Past 5, I could not tell you what the movies are about.
Yeah, I sort of like I have the markers because I know Seven, I guess, was Paul Walker's last one, right? So that was
it that one? Okay.
I think that was the one. That was the one that James Wan did as well. So that's the only reason I saw that one even. But like, yeah, I didn't watch the ones that followed that. I don't know. For me, it felt like, you know, losing Paul Walker was definitely sort of like it should have been a stopping point to that franchise because he was such a pivotal part of it. And so when his character went off into the distance, I felt like they should have cut it short there. They could have ended on a high note with that one. And I don't know. For me, it just felt like that was the end of the franchise for me. Like, I don't feel the need to see the other ones or continue the story or anything like that.
Yeah, he was pretty much the main character because he was the main focus of one. You know, Vin Diesel was not even in the second one.
Right.
His buddy in that movie was Tyrese Gibson's
Right.
was it Roman character. And then three, none of them were in the movie. I think Vin Diesel makes a cameo at the very end of the third one. And then from there on, we get like the same. I think four, five, and six are like the drug trade and like pushing drugs with cars. And then like the seven, eight, and nine have been like tech focused, like, you know, trying to stop a tech attack on the world that would, you know, mess everything up.
Whatever.
I don't know.
Whatever. Forget about it. What else did you watch this week?
I was kind of bored in, you know, USA or TNT, I forget which network or FX. They were playing the Avengers movies or like Captain America because, you know, it's 4th of July weekend. You know, I started watching a little bit of the first Avenger, Captain America, the first Avengers. You know, like, I was like, you know what? I think it's about time I rewatch both Infinity War and Endgame because I only rewatched them in theaters. Like, I haven't seen them at home since then. And I remember, like, I made Endgame like my number one movie of 2019. And you know, I'll say this: I'll say that I still have the same amount of enjoyment for these movies. And you know, and even if I knew the beats and even if I knew the plot points that were going to happen, I still got goosebumps. I still had my hairs were standing out at the end of at the end of my arms, my neck. And, you know, I was getting, you know, like that same, you know, adrenaline rush as I was watching it as the first time. And you know, the end game, I still cried. It squeezed two tears out of me after Iron Man died. I didn't expect that. You know, I still have the same amount of enjoyment when watching these movies. But going back, I probably wouldn't have made it my first one because the reason I made it my first one was not only because the movie really lived up to my expectations, but it was also that theater experience where everyone was like cheering. And I was like, the first time, I don't know if I talked about this on the podcast, the first time I went in for the first one, like the opening night, there was a lady crying, like sobbing, like two rows in front of me, like sobbing to the point where it was like someone that she actually knew died in front of her. She was like that kind of crying, like the heavy breathing crying. And that goes to show how, you know, important and influential these movies have been for general audience goers. But you know, I still think they're great movies. I don't think I would have changed my scores for them on Letterboxd or anything. I still had a lot of fun with them.
Would it hold up as your number one movie of the year
No,
when it
no.
came out?
I don't think I would probably top five at least. But I don't think it's number one.
I mean, like, as much as I've said about that movie, like, I can't deny the fact that that last, what, hour and a half of Endgame is spectacular. Like,
Yeah.
there's absolutely no denying that. I still
And
haven't played on Infinity War, though.
I'll say that also this Chadwick, no one can play Black Panther as Chadwick did. Even if
Yeah,
the little amount of screen time that he had in those two movies, you know, it's his role. Like, no one could take that away from him. And I'm really, you know, it's a sad loss to see in both the Marvel Cinematic Universe and, you know, in movies as a whole.
it's tragic, and I agree with you. Nobody could take that role. I'm interested to see what Ryan Coogler does, but I don't know. To me, it's even like, why are you moving forward? Black Panther 2, like, pay homage to him. I understand the desire to want to respect that, but like, I don't even know if it's necessary, really.
I have no idea where they would go. Like,
Right.
it's
It's
baffling.
really interesting, but I trust Ryan Coogler at the same time. So like, there's that part of it. It's tough. It's really tough. What else?
I'm a few episodes into Twin Peaks 2, and it's finally giving me that David Lynch weirdness that I was hoping for from season one. It's like, you know, it's like the first season was 8 episodes long. This one's 22 episodes. And they did the same thing. The first episode of season two is an hour and a half long feature length thing, and it still has the same like stuff that didn't like the soapy feel to it, the bad soundtrack, but they're really leaning into the surrealistic aspects of the show. And you know, I was talking to somebody on Reddit, and he told me that you're gonna get the weird stuff in season two, but the back half of season two just, you know, it's bad because they try to put do too much, and the story goes all over the place, and it's already as soapy as it is right now. I can't really think about where else it would go with the story, because I'm like, what, 6 episodes into a 22-episode season? But I'm kind of, wary getting into that back half of season two, and I still have to watch the movie, and I still have to watch the Return series.
Okay, so season two is not the return. Season two is season two of the original series.
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. I thought the original series was just one season, and then season two would have been the return.
No, so it's 30 episodes for the first series, the prequel movie that came out after the original series, and then the return, which is like 13 episodes, I think.
Okay. Is this, I know we talked about a little bit, like at this point now, having gotten a little bit farther and being on season two, is this a series now that you say you recommend, or you're still not there yet?
I'm still not there yet.
Okay.
It's hard to say. I mean, it has that soapy appeal to it with like the myriad of characters and the weird plot points, and it being in a small town with like a, in a murder mystery, I guess. It's still say it's accessible,
Okay.
but I don't. I'll save my judgment for it until I finish the series.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I'm interested to hear what you say with the return, because like you said on last week's episode when you talked about season one, like people were putting that on their top like movies of the year list, like that year that it came out and stuff. So like I'm really interested to see if that one maybe hits a little bit, especially because you'll be a little bit more accustomed to the style maybe at that point. Like I just wonder if it'll hit maybe a little bit harder for you
And I
then.
saw the original watch like his like movies like Eraserhead and Mulholland Drive and
Right.
Blue Velvet.
Yeah, he's an acquired taste. I think I said last week that it's not even describable as an acquired taste, but like he's unique. Like I feel like I don't know. I'm hesitant to pass more judgment on David Lynch until I've seen more than just Mulholland Drive, so I won't say anymore. I watched a lot this week. I finished Psycho Pass finally, so I'll start with that actually. This has been a while. I don't know why, but for some reason I didn't feel the urge to binge this series. So I was doing like one episode a day, which is why it took me like a little over a month to watch it. But I'll say I liked it. I wasn't in love with the series, and I think it's sort of like it had its up and down moments. I think it starts to play with a grander scale sort of issue in terms of like the villain is not the only villain, but towards the end, you're sort of introduced to another sort of, I'm hesitant to say like villain, but another sort of plot point that like changes the perspective or challenges the main characters. And I didn't love it. Like I like the sort of meaning of it, but I didn't like the way it was executed per se. Like without spoiling, I'll just say the brains, like you probably know what I'm talking about with that. I didn't love all that stuff. And I liked it more when it was strictly about the main villain because that stuff was incredible, especially like when it sort of shifted into like hardcore, like neo-noir murder mystery. And I feel like we didn't get enough of that in the series. That said, like, well, that said, like, I think the main villain is one of the best villains I've seen on in anime at least, like in terms of the way that he challenges the ideals of society, and like you kind of, in a way, are rooting for him because of what he has to stand for, not necessarily by the methods of which he's doing it. I love that. I think the two main characters, Kogami and Akane, those two are really good. They play off each other well. I like how they sort of have combating ideals, but they meet in the middle somewhere. So it's cool to have like sort of a gray perspective on the heroes as well. Like not just gray, like everybody's sort of a gray character. There's not like a good or a bad, except for the people that are like straight up murdering. Like, and I like that perspective. I think the series is really good. I feel like it has a lot of ideas that could have been explored a little bit better. Maybe it does in further seasons, but I probably won't be continuing it since you said it goes downhill from season one.
I'll say this. I think the stuff that you're saying is completely justified. I think the reason I like it so much is because it's set in the setting of like the cyberpunk
I
and
love
like
that part of it. Yeah.
the neo-noir, the revenge aspect of it, and Shinya versus Shogo, and his dynamic with Akane. The thing that's bad about the show is pretty much what you pinpointed on with like the quote unquote secondary villain, and the stuff with the brains didn't bother me too much. I thought it was really interesting to see how the creators of this show were kind of like envisioning a future where something like that could be possible, like you're trying to envision how it's like justifiable and make trying to base it in realism. And I think that was really interesting to see. But the aspect of the show or the series as a whole, the reason why it's become such a downturn with like the second and third season and the subsequent movies is because the reason that the first season is so compelling is because we have that neo-noir revenge thriller crime thriller aspect to it. Whereas the subsequent, series and movies completely focuses on the Sybil system. There is no real intrigue and there's no real emotion behind the actual storylines. It just focuses on more on like the actual, like the crime coefficients, the being a latent criminal, the stuff that makes this society function and how there's pitfalls in regards to the Sybil system. That stuff is kind of boring. If you go too deep into it, it kind of gets really, it gets really, cumbersome. And, in not having that revenge neo-noir aspect to it that made season one so compelling for me is why the subsequent stuff isn't as good.
I'm glad you brought that up because I feel like that's a good framing device for season one. It helps frame the world that the universe is set in, or like
Yes.
that this show is set in. But you can't expand it beyond them. That's when they started to push the boundaries of the Sybil system in terms of what it's doing in society. Yeah, there are parts of it that I like, but you can't have an entire series built off that being like the crux of the plot.
The Sybil system is a complement to the neo-noir of season one, whereas it becomes the main focus of the subsequent stuff, and is why it's not as good.
It's what drives the main villain in season one to be the way that he is, and that's why that villain is so good, is because he's combating that. So that in itself, the Sybil system in itself, is not good enough to sort of be a thing for our heroes to go after, but the way that it drives people, that's more interesting to me. So that's why it's
There was a lot of potential to it, and that's why it's so disappointing to see how the other stuff came out.
In sort of the anime front, I'm watching Horimiya now. I'll talk about that next week, but I'll give a little teaser, two thumbs up. But I'll talk about it in depth when I finish it. I have two episodes left, and I don't want it to shit the bed in the last two episodes, so I'll hold my review on that. I watched The Man from Nowhere. Oh, were you gonna say something?
No, I didn't say. I was just laughing at what you said about, not
Okay.
finishing with Clan Ebb. I was
Right,
thinking of
right.
Clan
Yeah.
Ebb.
I don't even know if they talked about that on the podcast, but yeah, Clan
No,
Ebb
you
just,
didn't.
yeah, I liked it, and then I hadn't watched the final episode. I watched the final episode and completely fell apart for me, so I guess mini review for that. I was sort of back on watching some of the Asian cinema that I've been catching up on, so I went to watch The Man from Nowhere, which is an action thriller, a Korean action thriller. I liked it. It wasn't quite as good as some of the other recent Korean action thrillers that I've been watching. I think it's because it wasn't quite as gritty as something like I Saw the Devil or Chaser or anything like that. It was just more of a straight up action movie that had some violence in it, so it was good. It's definitely worth watching if you're exploring Korean cinema, especially on the action front. But I wouldn't say it's one of the first ones that you need to go check out. So check out The Chaser would definitely be my first recommendation in terms of thriller action movies in that genre. Watch The Night Comes for Us. This is an Indonesian action movie, starring Iko Uwais as well as Joe Taslim, one of the guy who played Sub-Zero in Mortal Kombat. So it's those two basically going up against one another. I absolutely adore this movie. I think it's really good. It's probably the most violent movie I've ever seen in my life. It's incredibly gory, incredibly brutal. There are a lot of knife fights, a lot of stabbing, a lot of blood. So if you have a weak stomach, don't watch this movie. Stay away from this movie because it's certainly one of the most, if not the most, violent thing that I've ever seen. But it's worth watching if you're into something like The Raid, because it's obviously sort of in that same vein, in terms of action. Because Iko Uwais is obviously one of the stars of this movie. It's sort of an underground, it's about an underground society that helps, protect Indonesia in a certain way, but also has some mischievous sides to it, and the combating of those two budding ideologies and whatnot. It's just really, really good action. If you're looking for well choreographed action, this is the one for you. You've seen The Raid, right? Both of
Yeah,
them.
so I think you're just making me want to watch these movies again because I haven't seen the second Raid. I've seen the first one, and I want to watch that Chaser. And I think after hearing this review, I think I just gotta do a binge at this point.
That's, I
Haven't
mean,
just
that's what
put
I
it
was
all
doing.
on one day.
That's kind of what I've been doing recently, and I put a pause on that because I was watching TV and whatnot, and I was with NBA playoffs, I just haven't had as much time to do all that, but I'm back on that binge, so I'm expecting to review at least two East Asian, movies a week now at this point. That's sort of the trend that I'm going on. But yeah, the night come like the with the ra I was actually looking to watch the rewatch The Raid, and it wasn't streaming anywhere, but then I found that this was streaming on Netflix, so I tuned in for this one. Yeah, like I said, it's incredibly brutally violent, but if you're a fan of The Raid movies, you'll probably like this one. Also, the guy who directed this is supposed to be directing the American remake of Train to Busan, so that kind of had
Oh,
me
damn.
intrigued as well. Yeah, and I assume this is the project that sort of got him that job, because it has that sort of, one shot long take violent action, so I'm assuming he's going to bring that to Train to Busan. I watched No Sudden Move. This is Steven Soderbergh's new movie that hit HBO Max this week, part of the Warner Brothers HBO deal. It's good. I've seen people raving about this on Letterboxd and like giving it like 4.5, 5 stars. I liked it. I think it's like a 3.5 to 4 star movie. Like, it's really good. It's sort of like a crime heist thriller in what you'd expect of Steven Soderbergh. It's got that sort of, you know, comedy that he injects into a lot of his movies, but also has that sort of suave nature to it. It's set in like 50s or 60s Detroit, so it's got a bit of a gritty quality to it from that perspective as well. I don't know if I'm maybe just not as big a Soderbergh fan as everybody else is. So even like with the Ocean movies, I like those. I think they're cool, fun movies, but I don't like, they're not the kind of movies that I go and rewatch a lot. And like, I feel like most people would say those are really rewatchable movies. Where do you fall on Soderbergh as a director?
Yeah, I'm in the same exact boat as you. I think the Oceans movies are very fun, very watchable. But outside of that, I haven't really seen anything that's really knocked me on my ass. Like, right. Logan Lucky was fine. I don't really find myself trying to rewatch that movie. He made Contagion, didn't he?
Yeah.
I saw that at the height of like the COVID scare and like the conspiracy theories about bats and like they're coming from China and how it would be like the degradation of society. That movie, it's kind of hard to say how I feel about it because I was, you know, kind of influenced by what was going on in the news at the time. But I think I would say it's a good movie. But outside of those two, like outside of the Oceans and then Contagion, I wouldn't say he's an incredible filmmaker that I would go out of my way to see. He had that movie with Meryl Streep, The Laundromat?
Yeah, I did not like that movie.
Yeah, so that one wasn't received very well. And then he also had that movie with Claire Foy.
Unsane,
that was shot on an iPhone.
Right. I mean,
something, another movie that was kind of, I guess you could say gimmicky, it wasn't received very well. It had like a very, you know, lukewarm reception to it.
It was okay.
So he's not really a filmmaker I go out of my way to see.
Right. I wonder what it is. I wanted to watch it. I want to watch Traffic because I've heard that's one of his better movies, and that's one that I haven't seen yet.
Oh, so, Traffic 2. I remember watching that. That didn't stick with me.
Oh, really? Because that's one that Benicio won his Oscar for, too. So I want to obviously check it out for that. But that's one
I
haven't seen.
I'll say it's good, but the sepia tones, the cinematography just kind of threw me off.
It has that color look to it, right? Yeah.
The color grading was weird.
Right. I'm going to check that one out sooner rather than later because it's nearing the top of my watch list. So maybe I can review that. And then finally, Fear Street, 1994. So Fear Street is a trilogy that Netflix is doing. 1994, 1978, and 1966, I believe. So 94 was released last week, 78 comes out this week, and 66 comes out next week. So they're doing like a trilogy all in the span of July. And the same director, I think, did it, some overlapping cast and whatnot. But it's basically, this trilogy tells the story of this town and its sort of morbid, tragic past of serial killers and cults and whatnot. And so it's interesting to see it framed through 1994 being the first one, because you would think it would go forward in time, not backward in time. Mm-hmm. But it's what this does is it's sort of, like I said, it's the same director helming all of them. So she's taken like inspiration from like 90s slashers, most notably Scream, which if anybody knows is in my top, you know, 5 movies of all time. And is sort of injecting that into this sort of, it's basically an homage to 90s slashers is the best way to describe it. And for that, like, I absolutely loved it. Cause I love Scream, especially. There are shots, especially like in the opening, that are almost straight up pulled out of Scream. And I love the way the director paid that homage to that movie, and I just love what she did with this. Like, I wouldn't say this is necessarily like revolutionary horror by any means. Like, I'm not gonna say that everybody needs to go and check this one out, but because I'm such a big fan of 90s horror, this pushed all the right buttons for me, or 90s slashers rather. It pushed all the right buttons for me and got me in that sort of right mood. And it was like, it kind of exactly what I was looking for, as this sort of like, you know, fun, you know, but still pretty gruesome, throwback horror movie that, you know, had some good scares but also played more in terms of like the enjoyable aspects of it. It wasn't just focused on the horror side of it. So like, if you're looking for that kind of throwback horror that's a lot of fun, this is definitely the one that you'll check out. And I'll be obviously reviewing 78 probably next week's episode, and 66 the following week's episode. But it's also cool to see Netflix doing an experiment with that, where they had a trilogy all coming out, you know, one after another, and there's like, you know, there's stars from like Stranger Things, like Maya Hawke is in this one, Sadie Sink is in the next one. So like, if you have an appeal to that sort of vibe that maybe Stranger Things even gives you, then this might appeal to you, because it definitely like harkens back to a lot of that.
Speaking of Stranger Things, I wonder when we're gonna get the actual release date in the trailer for it, because I thought it was gonna come out this summer.
Right, I think COVID probably shut down production on that one as well. So my guess would be maybe this year.
Maybe. Is this the first horror movie that was that came out this year, right?
1994? Yeah, it came out last week. Yeah.
So is this the first horror movie that was good that came out this year? Because I remember last year we got like The Lodge, Relic, that one COVID one, I forget what it was called. That was shot on like a found footage kind of thing.
Oh, Host. Host. I love Host. Yeah. This what was the movie? Saint Maud came out this year, I guess.
Oh
technically,
yeah, Saint Maud, yeah.
Which I loved. But yeah, this is one I've seen a couple other horror movies this year, but this I think would probably be my number two behind Saint Maud in terms of quality horror that's come out in 2021. But we've got a lot of horror movies coming out. Like, I definitely like this better than Conjuring and stuff like that.
The Conjuring.
I mean, the first
good horror movie, as one I want to say.
Right. Yeah. I think in terms of like, because I guess Saint Maud, like the release date kind of bleeds into a few different years.
Yes.
So I guess from that perspective, yeah, this would technically be one of the best horror movies that's come out this year so far.
Wasn't Saint Maud like Sundance 2020, 2019?
I think it was TIFF 2019 and then Sundance 2020, and then it had a original release date was planned for late 2020 and then it got delayed. So yeah.
Damn.
Well, yeah.
I'll check this one out if I have time for it. But I really want to look at the Asian stuff that you've been referencing these past few weeks.
I can give you some recommendations when we get off too, because I've been watching so much of it the past year.
Tell me the streaming services too.
They're all on Hulu. Every single one of these is on Hulu. So like that's where The Wailing, Chaser, Yellow Sea, these are all like on Hulu. So.
You know what's funny? Netflix took Twin Peaks off of its platform and I had to go on Hulu to watch the rest of it. So Hulu's been pretty clutch.
I'm surprised. It was Showtime was the original? Showtime did the return? Or
Did the return.
Okay. So
CBS did the original.
Okay. I wonder how they ended up on Netflix then. That's pretty interesting. And now I guess they're shifting over to Hulu. But
well,
I wonder how
the movie and the return aren't streaming anywhere, so I don't know how I'm going to watch those when I finish series.
I'm sure you'll find a way. But yeah, I'll hit you with those recommendations when we get off, and I'm looking forward to talking about those more on the podcast. But that'll bring us to a close for this episode. Thanks for joining us, Sam. Let people know where they can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at Sam0so, and on Instagram at Sam Osorio, Osorio.
Find me at Rodsaw236. Check out my blog, rodsaw.com. I wrote a piece on your name that I put a lot of my energy into. It was kind of the piece that was blocking me for a long time. I wasn't doing much writing because I wanted to write this piece, and I finally wrote it, got it out of the way. So definitely check that out. And that'll bring us to a close for this episode. As always, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Share it with your friends and family. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Anchor, and all the other popular platforms. We'll be back next week talking more Fear Street, hopefully talking some Asian cinema. So come back and join us.